Yes, it was a time. What is your name again?
My name is Anthony Young.
Anthony Young. Anthony, there's, or Tony, whatever you go.
Yeah, Tony's fine.
Those were days that you have no idea what kind of people live and worked on this program.
I'm 55, so that'll give you the context of what I was aware of as Apollo was going on.
I came in 65 in July when I was just got my PhD, I just turned 26 or 27, I guess. Anyway, the people that Shoemaker got together here and the people that were put together in NASA and Houston and Cape Kennedy and so forth, they were a different breed than the people today. Now, I may sound like an old fart who said, we had better things in those days. NASA can't do, except for the unmanned mission, NASA can't seem to get their ass out of gear.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean,
and that's off the record, of course.
They have no idea what kind of dedication it took. Everything was redundant. Everything on the Saturn V was multiple redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
Every wire was redundant. And everything had to be, every time they made a move or change in the wiring, or they connected a wire, 6,000 people, it seemed, had to sign off on this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say the old story, the airlines are hurt for the gas mileage, so that you cost too much. So they're cutting back things like maintenance. Well, this is the kind of thing I foresee what's happening in NASA, is they're cutting back all that. Now,
you know what they did?
We had a national obligation and a national interest. We had the money. The Russian race is what really triggered it all. Yes, I agree to that. To tell you the truth, the whole Vietnam thing to me was a blur because I wasn't involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in Apollo. So the 60s was the Apollo mission.
Well, you were focused on what you were doing. But
yeah, and the only effect the Vietnam War had on us, we did both for a long time, was it scrapped the last few missions, and people got tired of seeing these clowns, as they put it so politely, when they sent thousands of emails after Apollo 17 to, or Apollo 16 and 15 actually, and 16 and 17 to the network saying, I miss my soap operas, and I think the goddamn guys running around on the moon. We're sick of it. Anyway, that's the kind of mentality that the people who were haven't changed. It's just that we had a group of people from every lowly person. Engineer there was over 200 and some thousand people that worked on Apollo.
I've heard it's closer to 400,000.
Well, maybe. But you get on, well, now there's people who knew somebody that worked on it, so they say that.
Right.
But in those days, when you got on an airplane, which we were always doing, we had our own brains playing for a lot, going to Phoenix and stuff, but we did a lot of flying back and forth to Cape Kennedy and the Houston and NASA headquarters and this and around the world training the astronauts for a little glory. But anyway, everybody on the plane talked about Apollo, and you sit next to somebody, and if they saw you looking at stuff on Apollo, they'd get so interested. The whole trip between here and Washington, you were talking to somebody who was fascinated, and then some guy behind him would come up and listen. Nowadays, you're lucky you don't get mugged at the airport. You know what I mean?
Right.
Nobody's going to talk to you about anything. But it was a different world.
It was a different, in fact, it was a vision. And
I
think this new vision, I have a final chapter in the book on that, but to this day, I am still astounded by Project Apollo.
Oh, it's amazing.
This thing should have taken 20 years when we had nothing but slide rules and drafting pencils. And yet the most complex machines, the biggest history has ever seen or will see, were done in an eye blink.
I know. And that is what amazes even those of us and the astronauts that did it today. And we took it all so commonly for granted that nobody, I mean, to have the astronauts going up and down the elevator in our building here in Flagstaff, down at the bank, the old four-story bank building in Flagstaff down there when I was, during Apollo, out where my office was for a while, we were spread all over Flagstaff. We didn't even think anything of it. They'd show up one day and we'd brief them and this and that. They'd go up down the elevator. Nobody even knew they were here most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so commonplace. And we trained them to actually go to the moon and walk on the moon and stuff. And the Navajos, I remember, they sit out there on their horses on the reservation. And you should have seen their faces when that flying machine, when that Boeing or that Bell Aerospace flying machine took off.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. They just ran with their horses as far and fast as they could.
It's like the alien astronauts
thing.
Von Daniken all over again, you know.
Yeah, and the old story they asked what we were going to do there. We had to get permission, you know, to use the reservation.
Oh, sure, yeah.
North of Meteor Crater and stuff. And I hope he did. And we did. Schumacher asked him one day, they asked him, what are these guys doing out here? And he said, well, they're going to go to the moon. And this one old chief said, translated to say, well, our people's already been there. And he said, oh, yeah. And he said, well, is there anything you would like to tell them when they get there? And they said something, and they wrote it down. So later I found out what it said was, don't make any trees with these white guys. Now, I can't verify that. That may be a rumor, but that's what I heard.
Okay. Let me ask a question here. Because I've been trying to establish how the EVA traverses were actually planned for 15, 16, and 17.
Well, you're talking to the right guy.
Okay. Because until today, I've spoken with Dave Scott, John Young, Charlie Duke, mm-hmm. Gene Cernan, and I'm hoping to speak with Jack Schmidt. Of course, I won't be speaking with Jim Irwin anytime soon.
Oh.
But I have not been able to find the proper source for how that's a big deal. I mean, site selection is one thing, but the traverses at each landing site, I have not been able to find how these were planned.
That was basically our doing. We ended up mapping the sites in various scales. We mapped it at 50,000, and we mapped it at 25,000. We did all the maps here in Flex, and we had our own map group and everything. And then we mapped it. I think the high res was 12,500. I did for the 15 site.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the guys who mapped it, the sites, especially at the high resolution, like myself, we decided where the best possible place to get the best geology return would be. It was nobody else but us. It was not Houston. It was not anybody. It was basically us. In the case of 15, it was myself and Jim Head primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And Gordon Swan, who was a principal investigator for Apollo 15 on the geology experiment. Hell, most of the places you don't even read about them. When you're looking at the experiments on Apollo, you don't even see the geology experiment. I mean, it's a LSEP and all that. But yeah, I mean, nobody even knows there was one.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was there in Houston Mission Control for all the missions except 11. And when I was in the hospital, I got run hit by a damn truck after Apollo 11, daydreaming with the orders. Well, yield sign and damn near got killed.
Oh, my goodness.
I was in the hospital during Apollo 11, 12, and Gordon wanted to put a live video, audio feed from Houston to my room when I was in the hospital so I could help him. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I'm seeing spiders crawling on the wall. I don't, you know, I'm not going to help me, be much help. But anyway, what we did was we'd give a preliminary traverse plan. I got all the meetings in my book about when we went to Houston.
So these are, okay, your proposals for the traverses were presented in Houston.
We would go down and present it to
yeah.
the crew in Houston, or
mm-hmm.
most of the time in Houston. As we got closer to the mission, we went to their living quarters in Cape Canaveral. So we'd present the crew. Scott was one hell of a sharp listener and geology-type interest, unlike Shepard, who really hated geology. And we'd go down and present it to the crew. And to the hangers-on from NASA, there's the Traverse Planning Committee and all that. I mean, the rover and the committee and all this. And the guys in charge of tools and what procedure, the procedure of people. And we had to follow all these rules. We didn't have computers, so every time
mm-hmm.
they wanted to make a change in the Traverse, we had to recalculate the whole damn logistics as far as oxygen usage, the whole thing. We learned to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we did all that by hand. There was no way else to do it. And if they would say, okay, Jerry, I want you to, you know, why are we going here? You know, understand. Okay, we're going up to the St. George Crater because it's a large crater, intersect the rill, and it's on the bottom of the slope from Delta, Headley Delta, and it will excavate stuff from both places.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to sample that. You want to go up on the slope of Hadley Delta to try to find the Ignorthus site, which they eventually found in the Genesis Rock, right where we told them it would be. And then you want to go over to the rill and look for layering. And then, after about two or three presentations to them, some of them were NASA headquarters, but they would, on the one before last, Scott came, after it was over, I presented the case for going to the North Complex. I had always been interested in it because it was very low in albedo north of the rim, limb. I'm also the one that realized there was a ray coming right from where the rim, where the limb landed. There was a ray from Autolycus, I think, coming through there.
Now, I've heard the term used, but I need to understand it better, a ray.
A ray from the crater, an ejector ray.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was probably a molten mixture of molten rock and debris that, like on Tycho, they go far, halfway around the moon.
Yes.
And I also was the first one when I mapped the site and did the traverses and mapped the site in stereo from the Apollo 14, I guess, metric camera pictures or whatever took the mission before always tried to get metric pictures of the next mission, you know.
Yes, that's right.
So we did stereo mapping. I did stereo mapping of the site. And I found there was a lip on the rill. I have no doubt there's a lip. As you go from the limb landing, proposed landing site over to the rill, you're going to go upslope. And sure enough, Dave, one day when he was on the moon, I had my earphones on down there. And I heard him say, well, we're going up here, Houston. And there is a lip on the moon. And I thought, I think Jim Head said, good go, you know. Anyway, so we presented all these things, and then we got down to, we had to have also contingency traverses for walking.
Yes, Dave Scott mentioned that to
me. Yeah, and so we planned those, and they had to be, of course, based on the limit that they could walk with a lot of contingency. We had rules from the mission operations people about how much time you could give with leeway. I mean, you couldn't get them back to the limb when they had 2 or 3 minutes if you have left.
Sure.
You know, so every time they made a change, we have to recalculate. And we did the cuff checklist we did all those here, what they were doing at each station. And of course, in Houston, we'd make them up, you know. We didn't do the cuff checklist. We put them in the data, we put them in our data package, but as far as putting them on their cuff, that was Houston's job.
Right.
But they were in our data package. I have an Apollo 11 through, I have all the data packages here. I have an 11 when it hasn't even opened from the bands that were wrapped around it. And I had Apollo 15 maps I did, and Apollo 14 maps I did. We did them here in Flagstaff. Our photo lab did them. I did the designing of them, and we also did the topography for them. We did everything here. And so the last time I went before last to them, before the mission, I got the dates in my book here of when these meetings were. It was, I gave my little spiel for the traverses, and I also gave a spiel for where we couldn't get to based on what we had done so far because of the logistics timeline. I said, I really would like to get you up to the North Complex, which is north of you, because there was a bunch of craters there that, yeah, they look like impact craters, and they turned out probably to be impact craters. But I said that the albedo of that whole valley is filled full of lava. Seems to go over those craters, and they're really low albedo. You know, probably why they were low albedo is because they were fairly old, and all the impacts probably threw a lot of basalt up on them. It's on the hill there, low hill. That's probably what happened. But I said there's a possibility, and I got Dave very excited about this, that there's some volcanic activity there, that maybe cinders had come on and, you know, covered them or something. Or the lava could have actually been higher over those craters, and then when it drained out and devolatized, it drooped down, so you could see the craters again. Well, it turns out that even if they had gotten there, they would have seen probably that they were impact craters. But I still say it was weird, and everybody agreed with me. Anyway, he jumped on this, and so one day, I guess 6 months before the mission, he said, "You know, where would you take me if?" I could find an extra hour on the surface. And I said, well, how are you going to do that? He said, well, let me worry about that. Nate seems to have a big forgetfulness about the work that our group did for him.
Well, it's interesting. When I interviewed him, and all he mentioned was, it's great getting in this room with experts. When we were planning the mission profiles,
right.
He didn't name any names.
He probably forgot them.
Maybe so.
Anyway, yeah, he's just that way. Anyway, so I said, well, okay. I said, I'd take you up to the North Complex. And I said, it's pretty far, but you'd have to have at least an hour. And you wouldn't be able to stay there very long. And he said, well, work it out for our next meeting. So I did, and Jim and I did most of it. Jim and I kept calling each other. And this and that. We didn't even have an email, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they left in June, was it, at 71, or...
Mm-hmm.
Or
the exact mission date?
15,
I think it was. I thought it was in July, but I don't
have
it right in front of me.
This was like in March mm-hmm. or April or June. I don't know. Yeah, maybe it was in April or May. We had a final traverse briefing before the one we actually gave them while they were in Houston at the mission in their living quarters, which was just a few weeks, a days or a week, whatever.
Yeah.
They left. And I went to that dinner. But so I presented the case to them on the traverse, and he really liked it. He said, let's go with it. And it turns out that, as you know, that damn drill got stuck in the ground, and it was so important to get that.
Oh, they got a heck of a time trying to
get that 1 meter drill. All the fingernails fell off, turned black and fell off later. And I think everyone probably had the same problem. But Dave Scott, who's very strong, well, they're both very strong, but he twisted that thing until his fingernails all just turned black and fell off eventually. It must have been excruciatingly painful. And just goes to show you what kind of men they were.
Really?
And so we spent the hour they were going to spend on my traverse, and at the end of EVA 2, going back a minute, he took those 500-millimeter pictures from the Hadley Delta, remember?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. He took 500-millimeter pictures from Hadley Delta and somewhere near where they found the Genesis Rock, if I recall, Station 6 or something. Anyway, and when he panned over and shot the pictures of the North Complex, he said, and I got it here on my wall, I got to pull it. He said, Yeah, let's get out of this little boulder field first. Okay, we'll take a look a little left here. Okay, we can look at Pluton. That's the crater in the
right. And I remember him saying,
we'll see Pluton all the way, and the limb is silhouetted right against the base of Pluton, so we can't miss that. And just to the right of it is Shabra Hill, which we'll be heading for tomorrow. The collection of representative samples was accomplished in the general vicinity of all the pre-planned locations except for the North Complex, Shabra Hill, which was not reached because of the lunar drill.
Was this part of the stand-up EVA, the photo shoot?
No, actually, this is when he, I can see the limb in the picture. This is from from Hadley Delta when they took the 500-millimeter lens of the limb in the foreground at distance and Shabra Hill.
Okay.
And the big Pluton crater. Yeah, so my claim to fame there, which I've only seen one thing on the internet where some guy wrote a book or a listing of unofficial names on the moon, and it's listed in there. That's the only thing I've ever seen on it. And on the Apollo Lunar Journal, I did write to Eric. I did contribute a lot to Eric, whatever his name is.
Eric Jones.
And I contributed a lot of true stories to him about that, the Shabra Hill thing and all that. Nobody really knew what that was. And I said, well. And also, Dave Scott said, I wrote a paper with the crew of 15 after the mission, and
mm-hmm.
I explained, in fact, during the mission, there was an interest, I was interested in it, because they said, well, we stopped the rover here. There seems to be a glassy crater to the right of us. See, we trained them so well, unlike the left 12 and 14, especially 12, where they cussed a lot and they didn't say anything. Dave Scott and General, when we had really, and I give credit a lot of that to not only ourselves, but to Lee Silver, too.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say, like, oh, Jesus Christ, Jim, look up there, there's a big rock there. And see, that told us nothing.
Right.
So what we trained them to do was to say, okay, we're on the rover at this heading, and at 1 o'clock, about 10 meters away or 20 meters away, there's this crater, looks like about 3 meters wide, has a big boulder on the top of it, on the rim of it. And they said, it was, there's glass, as they went by it, they said there's glass in the bottom of the crater, which they had seen since Apollo 11, and nobody could explain it. Tommy Gould came up with this ridiculous idea that was that the craters acted like a parabolic mirror and melted the glass in the bottom of the crater. Well, everything he ever thought of was completely crazy. But anyway, as they went by, they said there's this big black rock on the rim that has glass over it. Damn, just like that, my brain snapped in during the mission. I said, I looked at Jim Head and I said, I know now what's causing the glass in the bottom of this little crater.
Huh.
I said, I'm going to write a paper on that. And I did. And it was the fact that, and I put the crew's name on it. Well, when I read the Apollo Lunar Journal one time a few years back, Dave Scott said, yeah, Jim and I wrote a paper on that about this, about that particular crater and that rock. We wrote a paper on that. See, this is the way he does. I wrote the paper, and I put their name on it.
Right.
You know, and I maybe that's why he doesn't call me or correct me, you know, whatever anymore. He's probably embarrassed, but I told the story truthfully.
Yes.
And I said, hey, here's what happened. And I wrote the paper and sent it to them for review and edit, yes. But I said, actually, I was a senior author. But I couldn't let him get away with it. I don't care who he is.
Right.
To me, he's just another, you know, astronaut. But anyway,
You know what I noticed about watching these DVD sets?
Mm-hmm.
The 15, 16, 17, all the astronauts are constantly talking in geologic terms.
Yes, they are.
And
well, of course,
it's just like you say, yeah.
That's because we did such a tremendous job. I'm not taking anything away from Lee Silver and his ability to train them. He's a teacher, he's a professor, he's been a professor of geology for years. And he has a good reputation for that. And he taught at Caltech, and he was very influential. Schmidt thought highly of him. And,
mm-hmm.
and the other guy that doesn't get credit for a lot of the training is the guy from Penn State.
There's another gentleman who's actually I've got binders for everything here. I'm flipping.
Why can't I remember?
Not Elbaz.
No, God, don't even talk to me about it.
Oh, gosh, I didn't. I hope it's not a hot-button issue. Cause
he takes more credit for things he never did. He was never on a single geologic field trip. Not a single one.
He's in a lot of their pictures, the NASA pictures.
Maybe in Houston, but he was never on one of ours. He was never invited.
Yeah.
But his story of taking credit for things goes all the way up to the shuttle program when I was with two colleagues and I had discovered these radar rivers in Egypt with the shuttle radar. And that was me and my colleague, Jack McCauley and Carol Breen.
The one I'm talking about is Gary Lofgren?
No. He's one of the Houston...
Okay. He's the only one I've been able
to... He's one of the better of the geologists down there. We have another story about the training that you need to read a book about, all the fights with the big battle we had with the Houston geologists and the training exercise. I mean, the early training of the astronauts, where we had a group down there that we sent down to Houston at the NASA's request,
mm-hmm.
and we had a promise, Shoemaker had a promise that they would not try to reinvent the survey down there. This was back in 63 or 4 when he met with NASA headquarters, and they wanted him to come start a training group down there for geology training of the astronauts. So we sent down some of our top, you know, experienced geologists down there, headed up by Dale Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jackson didn't take any crap off anybody. He had a tremendous history in the survey, and he was really well experienced. They hired a bunch of PhDs, despite what NASA said they were promised not to do. They hired a bunch of new guys, fresh out of school, to try to take over our job down there and try to, you know, so they could get the program and training and not us. There was a lot of hatred and stuff. We didn't have time to hate anybody. They were just incompetent,
mm-hmm.
and they had no experience. And all these guys did was get in the way, and they ended up lecturing the astronauts about the mineral composition of calcite and all this stuff. They were bored to tears, and
absolutely.
They could care less
sure.
about that shit. They wanted to go out in the field, if anything, and they had a good time with each other. And starting in 63 through about 69 or 68 or 9, they were in big groups, and
mm-hmm.
they had a good time. They listened, but not as much as they did after they had a mission assigned. We wouldn't let them get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, hell, they just screwed around and just, you know, they had a good time getting away from their routine. But Elbaz was more or less, he's always been a self-promoter, a wheeler-dealer self-promoter.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I think of the things he did, like name moon craters after his kids and this and that, it just is Jack McCauley turns red when he talks about him. Because the guy is just really overrated, and he always has been.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, getting aside, see, we were also busy doing our job. We didn't care about that kind of crap.
Well, it's, you know, and that's just it. Everything was moving. Even though the training started in 63, as you said, toward the latter 60s, the pace of everything. What was the pace like?
It was unbelievable.
Okay.
We were training two crews at once, the backup and prime crews at once for the mission that's coming up and then the following mission.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we were analyzing the data from the crew, the previous traverse, the previous mission, and we were planning the next traverse somewhere, geologic field extras. We had to go and map the places. We had to know, we had to get an expert from the area to talk to them, whether it be Hawaii or Iceland or whatever. And all this was done by our people.
Mm-hmm.
And we never slept. I mean, we worked all the time. Just ask my wife. We were gone all the time. We worked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were dedicated to a task. And it worked out really well, and we did a tremendous job, but I still say, you know, we have never, the survey has, in Flagstaff and so in Menlo for doing the geologic mapping, a lot of the guys, some of the guys from our group didn't want to move to Flag, so they stayed in Menlo Park,
mm-hmm.
like Don Wilhelms, and so we did all
You mean Menlo Park, New Jersey?
No. California.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah, that's where the survey center is out there.
Okay.
Not the headquarters, but a survey field center.
Okay.
Middlefield Road in Menlo Park, California.
Okay.
Yeah, and so a few of them, like Wilhelms, did refuse to move away from San Francisco, his beloved North Beach area. So he stayed and mapped the entire moon and coordinated. Well, we did it. We did the mapping, and he coordinated it all. I did one of the maps of the moon, too, and I did Mars, the Mercury map, and all that. We're still in charge of mapping the solar system. We're still mapping now Venus and all the other satellites of Jupiter and Saturn. We've done all that, too. People have no idea what our little tiny building there did over those years.
Well, the thing is, too, unfortunately, a lot of people will remain, a lot of very talented people, productive people who contributed to the Apollo program will go unnamed because there were just so many of them.
Right. But see, our group, as a group, whenever the NASA people would come, or JPL, or the Houston people would first come to Flagstaff, they were just absolutely dumbfounded how little, what our little building there, we had one building for a long time up on the Mesa starting in late 64. They said, you guys couldn't do everything you do out of, we said, well, no, we're spread all over Flagstaff. We're in the bank building, we have a machine shop, a top grade machine shop here, and we got this and that all over town. We didn't have a building big enough. From the minute our building was finished in 1964 in November, right before I got here in July of 65, it was too small. It just barely held our administrative people.
Mm-hmm.
We went from a handful of like two people in 63, three people in 63 that first came to Flagstaff, to 110 by 1969.
Wow.
No, 200 and some by 1969, 215 or 20.
Wow.
That's how fast we grew.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When I was hired in 65, Shoemaker and Gordon and those guys, the branch hired 14 geologists that year, and I was one of them.
Okay, let me, Jack Schmidt plays very prominently because he was the only geologist to go.
And he was from our group.
Yes, exactly. And he is writing a book that, I guess he's finished the manuscript, but his publisher is also Springer Praxis, my publisher. So hopefully I'm using that will be the means that at least he'll be, I've got cooperation from all the astronauts.
He's asking me for a copy of mine, and I can't have to tell him that thing is not out yet, and nobody's going to be able to use the damn thing.
I really wish, because, you know, this title, Jerry, is frankly just the kind of thing I think Praxis would be interested in looking at, because they are focused on this type of, if you type in Praxis Publishers, the website will come up and you'll see what they publish.
Really?
And so Jack Schmidt's book will be published by them.
How do you spell Praxis?
Praxis.
Oh, yeah.
And my question is, I wonder, is it possible to, I mean, it's your copyright, or is it USGS copyright?
There is no copyright if it's a government.
Is it a done deal that they want to do this thing as an e-book, so to speak, or would you? Oh, okay.
I mean, it doesn't mean it can't be published somewhere else. It's just that I wanted to get it out as soon as possible.
Sure.
And if you do a professional paper in a survey, you're lucky if it doesn't. I think I talked to Wilhelm. There's a Geologic History of the Moon book, which I have got 4 or 5 copies of, and it's now out of print. It's been scanned, but it's that thing took. Oh, Christ. I don't know how many years it took him to publish that.
Mm-hmm.
Said he would never go through that again. Anyway, those things are selling for $250 a piece now.
Sure, when you can find, yeah.
Yeah, I've got 4 of them, I think. Anyway, I'll check into that. I also thought Northland Publishing out here in Flagstaff would be interested in it. I sent him a lecture I gave in town about the Flagstaff's role in the Apollo program and on PowerPoint, and they said they thought it was really exciting, but they didn't think it would sell enough books.
Praxis, the thing is, Praxis is a niche publisher. They know how to publish these things and make some money on them. You won't get rich on these things, of course.
I don't want to.
And that's not the point. They see themselves.